All right, welcome to Daily Power Parsha. Today is Friday, April 30th, 2021, a day in which my internet is a little wonky. But nonetheless, we are going to study Torah together as we conclude the Torah, our Torah exploration for the Torah portion of Emor. Once again, today's class, this whole week's learning is sponsored by our DPP community in honor of Ray and in memory of Ray's sister Lillian. May her memory indeed be for a blessing and bring blessings upon Ray and the entire Mishpacha. And may Lillian's inspiration continue to inspire all of us and give us all the blessings that we need.
Thank you very much.
Of course. Okay, I'm going to share my screen and we're going to jump right into our conversation. So let me see how to do that. Share. Torah reading for Emor, sixth reading. Here we go. We're in the middle of the holidays. Leviticus chapter 23. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, on the 15th day of the seventh month is the festival of Sukkot, a seven-day period to the Lord." So here we have our next holiday. Remember, middle of this portion, this parsha, we segued away from conversations about the priests and ritual purity and impurity, and we spoke about the ritual obligations for the holidays. We went through Passover. We went through the bringing of the Omer, the counting of the Omer. We went through, what did we go through previously? All right, other things. And now we went through Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Now we're speaking about Sukkot. So it begins on the 15th day of the seventh month, which is Tishrei. And it's a seven-day holiday. The Torah continues, verse 35. On the first day of the holiday, it is a holy occasion. And what does that mean? It means you shall not perform any work of labor. So holy occasion kind of is defined as a day in which work, avodah, is prohibited. Or malacha is prohibited. 36, for a seven-day period, you shall bring a fire offering to the Lord. So here we're more focused on the offerings, because it is Leviticus, than perhaps other themes, but although we'll get to other themes as well, but the first thing it mentions is about the offerings. So we need to bring a fire offering to the Lord, which is a burnt offering. On the eighth day, it shall be a holy occasion for you, and you shall bring a fire offering to the Lord. So the seven days are Sukkot, and the eighth day, Beyom HaShmini, the eighth day is a new holiday. It's another holiday. It's another fire offering to the Lord. It is a day of detention. It's atzeret, detention. I don't know if that sounds right. Detention usually means when a kid is misbehaving in school and they're sent to detention. But in this context, it means it's a day in which we're meant to remain with God after the 7 days. You shall not perform any work of labor. I'll tell you the analogy that our sages say. It's like a king or maybe a father or whoever that has the mishpacha. People gather, families gathering, you know, for 7 days, and then everyone's time to go home. And the father says, or the parents say, you know what, can you stay one more day? Just one more day if you can stay and we'll celebrate together. So that's kind of like what this is. It's the day of detention or retention. It's a day of remaining with God one more day. After the whole month of Tishrei, you have Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, 7 days of Sukkot. We don't run away right after the holiday. We have another one more day of holiday. We add an additional day. Verse 37. All right, these are God's appointed holy days. These are the holidays that you shall designate them as holy occasions on which to offer up a fire offering to the Lord, burnt offering and meal offering, sacrifice and libations, the requirement of each day on its day. Again, because we're discussing the holidays in the book of Leviticus, which is all about the temple and the priests and the service, so a major focus in the holidays is about what sacrifices are brought. And so the Torah is detailing what's done on a holiday. You offer up fire offerings, burnt offerings, meal offerings, sacrifices, libations, right? Every holiday per its specific requirement. And this is, yes, Ray.
Are you talking about Shemini Atzeret?
We are talking about Shemini Atzeret. Yes, the eighth day, which is the day of Atzeret, is Shemini Atzeret. Yeah. The question, though, is, this was trying to kind of like bavarin for what, like preempt, is why is Passover just a 7-day holiday, right? And Sukkot is an 8-day holiday. So, well, the simple answer is because the Torah says that. The Torah says that it's a 7-day holiday, and then on the 8th day is another day. It's a day of Atzeret, Shmini Atzeret. The question is why, and I said, after Tishrei, so it's hard to say goodbye. So Hashem says, you know what, give me one more day. You had your Sukkot celebration, you had 7 days of Sukkot, give me one more day. New holiday, Shmini Atzeret, the 8th day of holding on to you, so to speak. 7 day of Atzeret, this detention. I guess you could use that word. God says, you're with me, come with me. God says, let's celebrate one more day together. So it's actually a beautiful theme. And this is brought and then the Torah kind of summarizes about the holidays and the sacrifices. And then it says in 38, and this is apart from the Lord's Sabbaths, and apart from your gifts, and apart from your vows, and apart from all your donations that you give to the Lord. So these holiday sacrifices and offerings are aside from what you're going to bring on Shabbat, and aside from what you're going to donate whenever you feel like donating or giving or offering to God. These are the holiday offerings that are meant to be brought each holiday in its appointed time, on its appointed schedule, in its appointed prescription of what to bring and how to bring. The Torah now circles back, interestingly enough, circles back to Sukkot and fills in some more details that are not necessarily sacrificial related, right? But otherwise related to the holiday. The Torah says, but on the 15th day of the 7th month, right, which is Sukkot, when you gather in the produce of the land, so the holidays are also centered around agricultural events. So what happens on Sukkot, that time of year in the fall in Israel, they're gathering in the produce from the field. Because basically, let's say wheat, for example, you would cut the wheat in the spring or summer, or in the spring around Passover time, and then you would let it sit in the fields to dry out in the heat of the summer. And then before it starts raining, because you don't want soggy wheat, you want to grind it into flour, so it's got to be dry. So you would then bring it in around the fall season. So this is what the Torah is saying. So on the 15th day of the month, of the 7th month, which is Sukkot, when you gather in the produce of the land, you shall celebrate the festival of the Lord for a 7-day period, like we mentioned just a few verses ago. The first day shall be a rest day, and the 8th day, which was that extra day that we spoke about, also shall be a rest day. In other words, work is prohibited. Verse 40, and you shall take for yourselves on the first day of this holiday, of Sukkot, the fruit of the Hadar tree. We know that as the Esrog. You should also take the date palm fronds, which is the lulav, a branch of braided tree, which is the hadas or hadasim, and willows of the brook, the aravos. Take these four things. Basically, you take the citron, the palm branch, the myrtle branch, and the willow branch, put them together, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for a 7-day period. We shake the lulav, the esrog, the hadas, and the arava for 7 days, per the Torah's command right here. Verse 41, and you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord for 7 days in the year. It keeps on mentioning this. It's a 7-day holiday. All right, we got it. It is an eternal statute throughout your generations that you celebrate it in the 7th month. So we always do it till today. Sukkot is celebrated, 7-day holiday. We take the lulav, the esrog, the hadas, the arava. We bind them together. And we also try to do it in a sukkah. Verse 42, for a 7-day period, you shall live in booths, in Sukkot, in sukkahs, in booths. Every resident among the Israelites shall live in booths. So that's what we call a sukkah. We build it in the front yard, in the backyard. It has to be a temporary structure that goes outside under the stars or under the sky. No trees overlapping. It's got to go directly under the sky. And it's meant to be a temporary structure. Why do you build these sukkot, these booths? 43, in order that your ensuing generation should know that I had the children of Israel live in booths when I took them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. In other words, I housed them in temporary structures when I took them out of Egypt. And still they went with me, God says. We lived in a shack. And yet, you still followed me and you still were committed and you didn't run the other way. And that is a beautiful thing. And so essentially what God is saying is, I want you to remember my joy and your joy in our first apartment together when you lived in the huts. Every year, build a hut, live in it for 7 days, eat in it for 7 days, to remind ourselves of the origin of the Jewish people. Verse 44, and Moses told the children of Israel these laws of the Lord's appointed holy days. Moses communicated the holiday info to the Jewish people. I want to show Rashi's commentary. I love that I can do this on a phone. Rashi says about the booths. Rashi says, not so fast. It wasn't the physical booths. It was spiritual booths. Take a look. Build a sukkah because I had the children of Israel live in booths. Rashi says, these were the clouds of glory with which God enveloped the Jewish people in the desert, forming a protective shelter for them against wild beasts and enemies. So there's actually two, and he quotes Sukkah 11b, which is the Talmud. There are actually two opinions in the Talmud. One opinion says what I said before, which is the physical booths. And the other one says, no, we're not commemorating the physical tents or huts that they lived in the desert. We're commemorating the miraculous clouds of glory that protected the Jewish people. That's what we are commemorating. So a bit of a distinction, but yet both are beautiful in their own right. Okay. Can you guys see me, or do you see still my screen with the text? What do you guys see?
Now we see
each other.
Now you see each other.
The gallery. The gallery.
Okay. All right. So now you can see me, if you insist.
Now you don't.
Fine. Okay. Fine. You see me also. All right. So I stopped. I stopped sharing. Hey, I stopped sharing just for a moment to check in. So this was the sixth reading. We're going to continue in a moment with the seventh reading. But this was the sixth reading. And the sixth reading essentially is focused on concluding our tour through the Jewish holidays, the annual Jewish holidays. We went through Passover, the counting of the Omer, Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. Those are all of the biblical holidays. Any other holidays that we have are post five books of Moses. So Hanukkah and Purim and Lag BaOmer, which is today, and fast days and Tu B'Shvat and all these things, they're all post-biblical holidays, rabbinic things. These are not biblical holidays. Okay. So that is that. Okay. Make sense? All right. And again, the main focus was which sacrifices are brought on that holiday. Leviticus. It's all about the sacrifices. But at the end, the Torah circles back and says, oh, by the way, with the Sukkot, you got to mention also, you got to get your lulav, esrog, hadas, and arava. You got to get the four plants and do some shaking for 7 days and build yourselves a hut. So it kind of circles back to, you know, the protocol that we have till today for Sukkot, because we don't do the sacrifices, but we do the other items. Okay, now we're ready to jump into the seventh reading, which tells a story, a very strange story. Tells a story of the blasphemer, or blasphemer, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. The one who blasphemed the divine name, who cursed God. What's the story? What's the background story? So the background story that's told is as follows. There was a fellow, I'm going to pull up all the details here for myself. There was a fellow who was the son of a Jewish woman who had been assaulted, violated by an Egyptian taskmaster. So again, this is back in Egypt. There was a woman who was, I think it might have been even related to the man, the Egyptian that Moses killed, I think. I think it was something along those lines, maybe even connected. I don't remember. I can't say this with certainty, but it might even be related to the Egyptian. Remember the Egyptian was beating up a guy, a Jew, and Moses killed the Egyptian? Yeah. So why was the Egyptian beating up the man? So I believe the story was that this Egyptian was actually also violating this guy's wife. And to make sure that he didn't cause any problems, he was beating him up or trying to kill him so that to silence the husband. I believe this was all connected. Either way, there was one woman, a Jewish woman, who had been violated by an Egyptian, and she got pregnant from that violation. And she gave birth to a son. The son is Jewish because the mother was Jewish. But here's the challenge. What tribe is the son? Tribal affiliation, as we've talked about multiple times in these classes, the Jewish identity goes by the mother. The tribal affiliation goes by the father. So this guy's father was an Egyptian. So what tribe did he belong in? And you have to understand that when they built the Mishkan, you know, they encamped around the Mishkan, around the tabernacle, by their tribes. And so here you have this young man who sets up his tent near his mother's tribe. And basically, the fellow tribe mate said, look, young man, you're not of this tribe, right? Because your father is not of this tribe. Whatever tribe that was, it's not your... You're Jewish, but this is not your tribe. Now, it may sound harsh, right? Because, like, where's he supposed to go? Like, if not near his mother's tribe, like, then who else? What, he's going to go back to Egypt? Where are you sending him exactly? So I don't have an answer for that piece of it. But essentially, there was a court case that came up about whether or not he belongs to this tribe. And the court, or Moses, I'm assuming it was Moses, right? Or the court, or whoever was, said, no, I mean, it goes by the tribe, and that's patrilineal, and that's the father, and you're not of this tribe, because your father wasn't of this tribe. And he was so upset at the ruling, he basically uttered a word in God's name and cursed God, right? You can imagine a phrase that's, you know, like a frustration phrase or a negative phrase, cursing God. Okay, fine. So that's what he did. And the Torah said, it's like part of the Ten Commandments, right? You cannot curse God's name. So now they brought this case to Moses, right? It's never the original issue. It's always what happens next. Right? I mean, right? It's like always the cover up or whatever it is. It's always like the next piece. So now they come to Moses and they're like, okay, what do we do now? This guy cursed God's name. Moses asks God and we'll see what happens. It doesn't end well. Okay, for this guy. Let's take a look. It's a bit of a harsh story.
Rabbi?
Yes.
What about, so following up from yesterday's class, with the Messiah, and when we're all, you know, reinstated, I mean, are we going to find our tribes? Because we don't know our tribes now.
That's a really good question. I believe there will be some clarity in Messianic times. I believe that's one of the things. That's one of the things. Although at the same time, I think it also says that Mashiach is not about, you know, kicking people out who think they're in. But it is also going to be clarifying as far as, you know, who's what, where, when. Anyway, we have to look that up a little bit more. But my recollection is that there's a piece of that as well. Okay, I'm going to share my screen. Let's pull the text up once again. No, I want to pull up. Okay, can you guys see the text? Is it coming up?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Reading number 7, Leviticus chapter 4, verse 1. Well, it starts off innocently enough, and then it segues to this guy. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the children of Israel, and they shall take to you pure olive oil, crushed for lighting, to kindle the lamps continually. Again, even though this mitzvah was not for the priest, it's related to the priestly service of lighting the menorah. So the commandment is to tell the people to prepare oil to then go to the priest for lighting the menorah. Outside the dividing curtain of the testimony in the tent of meeting, Aaron shall set it up before the Lord from evening to morning continually. This shall be an eternal statute for your generation. So essentially what he's saying is that the menorah is set up in that temple building. Remember, there's like the outdoor area and then the indoor area. And there were two chambers, the inner chamber and the inner chamber that housed the ark, but not the innermost chamber. The other chamber, it was still in an inner chamber, housed three things: the showbread table, the inner altar for incense, and the menorah. So here, the olive oil is prepared by the people, and then Aaron, the high priest, shall set it up every day to light the menorah, every day in the evening until morning it needs to burn. By the way, that's what the Jews were doing in the story of Hanukkah when they were trying to light the menorah and they were looking for oil. They were literally doing this mitzvah of setting up, putting oil in and lighting the menorah, and that's why they couldn't, because they didn't have the oil, and then they found it, and it lasted for 8 days, etc. Okay, but this is the mitzvah, to light the menorah. Let's continue, verse 4. Upon the pure menorah, he shall set up the lamps, that means like oil, wick, etc., before the Lord continually. And you shall take fine flour and bake it into 12 loaves. Each loaf shall be made from 2/10 of an ephah of flour. And you shall place them into 2 stacks, 6 in each stack upon the pure table before the Lord. So now we have a discussion about another item in that space. We talked about the menorah. Now we talk about the showbread table. And that was a golden table that had stacks. Again, I would pull up a picture maybe. But remember, it's the one that had two columns of like a baker's rack almost, but made out of gold. And on those were supposed to go 2 stacks of 6 loaves, 6 vertically one side and next to it, 6 going up next to it. So again, verse 6, you shall place them in 2 stacks, 6 in each stack upon the pure table before the Lord. By the way, this is where the custom, the Kabbalistic custom comes from, to braid a challah of 12 strands to remind us of the 12 loaves that were always in this holy space before God. 12 loaves, again, some have the custom to braid their Shabbos challah with 12 strands. It's a very complicated braid, a 12-stranded braid, but it's got mystical, it's a mystical tradition and based on this mitzvah. Let's continue, verse 7. You shall place pure frankincense, spice, along each stack, like a spoon of frankincense, next to each stack, and it shall be a reminder for the bread, a fire offering to the Lord. Each and every Shabbat day, he shall set it up before the Lord to be there continuously from the children of Israel in eternal covenant. Essentially, what that means is that every Shabbos, they would replace the loaves with new loaves, and they would stay fresh from week to week. After the shift was done, they would take the loaves off, and the priests would eat it. And they would put on the new loaves. And it's there's a, the Mishnah of the Talmud gets into great detail about how they would switch from one set of loaves to the other. They would the goal was that the loaves should be continuously on the table. So even as they replaced them every Shabbat, they kind of slid one on while the other was being slid off. So it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of visually how to think about it. It's like, imagine you're like pushing a book on a table with another book and you slide it off and then the new book takes its place. So there's always a loaf or a half a loaf, right? There's always a loaf on the table. It's like you're just slowly segueing the one out while the other one comes in. In other words, you didn't just pull off the loaves and then replace them, because then for, you know, 5, 10, 30 seconds or a minute or two, it will be bereft of bread. You don't want to do that, so you literally, physically put them next to each other and slide one off as the other one slides in. I hope that makes sense. Let's continue back inside. And it shall belong to Aaron and his sons. That means that they get to eat it. And they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is holy of holies for them, among the fire offerings of the Lord in eternal statute. It basically, these breads, these 12 loaves, have the status of a sacrifice. So therefore, it needs to be eaten in the temple. It's a holy food, and it's eaten by the shift of Kohanim that are outgoing. Every Shabbat they would change shifts. The shift that was outgoing would eat of the loaves, and they would partake in it. Let's continue. Now we get to the blasphemer. Now we get to the story. Now, verse 10. The son of an Israelite woman, and he was the son of an Egyptian man, right? Like I said before, his mother was a Jew. His father was this assaulter, this Egyptian man. So this son went out among the children of Israel, and they quarreled in the camp, this son of the Israelite woman and an Israelite man. Because, essentially, this guy got into a fight with the other tribe mates about whether he was allowed to be there or not. So they got into a fight. And this guy lost the court case. Verse 11, and the son of the Israelite woman pronounced the divine name and cursed. As I said before, he got upset at losing the court case because he wasn't legally from that tribe because his father wasn't from that tribe. Again, the compassion element, I don't have a good answer for that right now. But legally, he wasn't of that tribe because his father wasn't of that tribe. His father wasn't Jewish. So that's how the ruling came down. And so he cursed God's name. Now we got bigger trouble. So they brought him to Moses. Until that point, it seems that the case was handled by the lower courts, by the other, you know, when Moses set up, based on his father-in-law's advice, set up the societal structure, there were other lower courts, and this was handled as pretty much a straightforward case. He doesn't belong to that tribe. His father wasn't from that tribe. But then he cursed, and now it's a capital case. So they bring him to Moses. The Torah says at the end of verse 11, by the way, who was he? Or what? His mother's name was Shelomit, the daughter of Dibri of the tribe of Dan. So now we have some more information. He was of the tribe of Dan. And that's where he was trying to live. And his mother was Shlomit. Her father was Dibri. And they said, no, you're not from Dan because your father wasn't. Your father's Egyptian. Why is her name mentioned? According to Rashi, it's to tell us that she was the only one to whom an Egyptian violated over the entire span of the slavery. This was the only situation that was this case. All right, let's continue. Verse 12. So they didn't know what to do with him. He had cursed God at this point. Cursed God's name. So they placed him in the guardhouse. Basically a makeshift holding cell. Not prison, but maybe a jail cell, like a holding place, until his sentence would be specified to them by the word of the Lord. In other words, they needed to escalate this to Moses, who would consult with God to figure out what to do with this guy. Verse 13, then the Lord spoke to... So, one second, I need to emphasize verse 12 about the guardhouse. The Rebbe points out that prison or jail is never the punishment. Even when Torah mentions it, it's only a temporary holding space until the sentence came down, or until the verdict came down. But that's not itself a verdict. Jail and imprisonment, the Rebbe was very much against that. Now, ask what about a person who's a danger to society? Okay, so yes, there are cases in which, you know, maybe it's necessary or whatever, or maybe there's other ways to figure it out. But either way, as a default thing, oh yeah, you stole money, so you're going to go to jail. That's not my kesha. What's the connection? Stole money, go to jail. You want to punish? There's other ways to punish. You want to get the money back? There's other ways to get the money back. So again, the Rebbe emphasizes here that this guardhouse was only used as a temporary holding until the sentence actually came down. Now, I mean, the guy may have chosen to stay in the guardhouse as opposed to receiving the sentence, which comes down, but nonetheless, let's go. Verse 13, then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, here you go, take the blasphemer outside the camp, and all who heard his blasphemy shall lean their hands on his head. And capital punishment, the entire community shall stone him. And to the children of Israel you shall speak, saying, in other words, make it known for all time, any man who blasphemes his God shall bear his sin. In other words, it's a problem. And at verse 16, and one who blasphemously pronounces the name of the Lord shall be put to death. The entire community shall stone him, convert and resident alike. If he pronounces the divine name, he shall be put to death. And if a man strikes down any human being, he shall be put to death. Oh, hold on one second. So that's now the law about, not now, but that's the Torah is clarifying the law about blaspheming, cursing God's name, and the punishment, right? We might have learned before in Ten Commandments, you know, don't take God's name in vain, don't curse God's name, whatever. But what's the punishment? Now we know it's capital. capital punishment. Again, with witnesses and warning, etc., it seems like in this case there were. Verse 17, and if a man strikes down any human being, he shall be put to death. So this is murder, capital punishment. And one who slays an animal, not capital punishment, shall pay for it the value of a life for the life he took. In other words, comes to human life, it's a capital case. Animal, somebody kills an animal, obviously not good at all, terrible, horrific, but it's not a capital crime. He's got to pay the value of the animal. He's got to make the owner of the animal whole. Verse 19, and a man who inflicts an injury upon his fellow man, just as he did, so shall be done to him. Namely, a fracture for a fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Just as he inflicted an injury upon a person, so shall it be inflicted upon him. Now hold on, you might think, whoa, the Torah is saying if you break someone's arm, your arm gets broken. No, that's not what it's saying. Fracture for fracture doesn't mean that. It means the value of the pain and the suffering and the medical bills and the lost wages and the mental and emotional distress, that's what must be paid. So when it says fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, it does not mean that if somebody injures someone else's eye, their eye is injured. It's the monetary value that's assigned for that. And you ask the question, well, how do you assign a monetary value for an eye? Okay, there's five categories. I've explained this before in other classes. We have five categories of financial penalty. Nezek, Tsar, Ripoy, Sheves, and Boshes. And what those are, Nezek is the damage itself. Tsar is the pain. Ripoy are medical bills. Sheves is lost wages. And Boshes is the embarrassment from this, like emotional injury tacked on top of all of this. Five categories of financial penalty associated with a person who physically assaults, God forbid, someone else. All right. And the value is assigned by the value of that which he hurt. So fracture for fracture. In other words, you assign the value of a fracture for the fracture that he caused, or an eye, the value of an eye, for the eye that he damaged, or the value of a tooth, a missing tooth, etc., and what that costs in dentistry bills, for the tooth that he knocked down, etc. So shall it be inflicted upon him is not physical, as I said, I'm just repeating myself, but rather it's financial. Now, how do the rabbis know this? How do we know this? Again, there are indications in the text. Wow, I just got an indication now my phone battery is just a few percentage points away from dying. So we'll have to summarize this in a bit of a quicker pace. So how do the rabbis learn this? How do they derive it? They have their sources. They have their, because it says at the end, Ken yinasein bo, so shall it be placed upon him. Here it says inflicted. That actually makes it more of a stretch. But in the Hebrew, it's Ken yinasein bo, so shall be placed by him. Nasan means given. What is given? You give money. You don't give injury. You give money, and that's a word, nasan, give, that's used by money. So that's how we learn that we're talking about money, financial payment, not, God forbid, hurting someone. Okay, let's continue. Verse 21, and one who injures an animal shall pay for it, and one who strikes a person shall be put to death. Again, reiterating the distinction between animal and human injury or killing. Verse 22. One law shall be exacted for you, convert and resident alike, for I am the Lord your God. No two sets of law, right? For the upper half or low, you know, for those, the haves and the have-nots, there's no such thing as have and have-nots. Everyone is under the same law. Verse 23, I'm just going quickly because I have 3% battery. And Moses told all this to the children of Israel, so they took the blasphemer outside the camp and stoned him. And the children of Israel did just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Again, there's no way around it. Certainly a harsh penalty. But, you know, the way that I can, what I can say with assurity is, I didn't write the laws. So, you know, don't blame the messenger. But clearly this is a capital case. And in that case, there were the witnesses and the warning that elevated to that punishment. I'm just walking around because I'm now on my phone, so why not? So that is the end of that story. So what's the moral of the story? Don't curse God's name, number one. What else is the moral of the story? It is don't injure people or, God forbid, worse, or animals for that matter. Right? We got to treat each other well and not curse God and build a sukkah and shake a lulav and an etrog. I think that's what we can all agree on from today's reading. All right, I want to wish everybody, as I approach 1% battery, it's going to cut out either way, so might as well end it with the blessings for Shabbat. I want to wish everybody Shabbat Shalom. Have a wonderful Shabbat and lots of peace and love and harmony and unity and blessings, especially with what just happened in Israel over the last 24 hours in Meron. We wish everyone who needs a healing, and everyone who needs comfort should have comfort, and only joy and only happiness should we celebrate together. All right, have a good Shabbos, everyone. We'll see you soon. Take care.
Shabbos.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Shabbat Shalom. We'll see you soon.